The topic that we're going to be looking at this evening is money. Money, one of those things that there's never enough of, right? I think we all seem to have more month than money when we go through most of our lives, that the month lasts a little bit longer than the money does. This evening we're looking at a warning about wealth, and that's the last thing that we need, right? A warning about wealth? None of us are wealthy, or are we? Let me see, has any of us gone without a meal this past week because we couldn't afford one? Have any of us been without heat because we couldn't afford to pay it this week? Have any of us been, or, well, maybe I should look around, are any of us wearing the same clothes now that we wore yesterday, and the day before that, and the day before that, because this is all we own? You know, I expect none of us answered any of those questions as yes. And yet, the vast majority of the world's population, if they were given those same questions, would be forced to answer at least one or two of them as yes. They could not afford multiple pairs of clothes or heat or even food. Are we wealthy? What can we use to determine the answer to that question? Maybe we do need a warning about wealth. Tonight we're beginning the final chapter in James' letter. James is beginning a new section here, but he's returning to a topic that he's dealt with before, the topic of oppression. And he's also returning to a topic of wealth, and he's brushed on that topic as well. Throughout the entire previous chapter, James had been dealing with the matter of worldliness, a topic that really boiled down to pursuing the things of this world in a manner that excludes God. That's what worldliness was. Just setting God aside and dealing with the things of this world as if that's all that existed. We live in this world. We have to interact with this world. There are even a lot of things that we need from this world. But we must always remember that this world is under the control of a sovereign God, a sovereign creator of this world. And so are we. We're under that control of his as well. Not only is this world under his control, but God has given us a lot of instructions about how we are to live within this world. He's given us wisdom from above that we are to seek after as we live our lives within the context of this world. We're to look for the wisdom from above. Failure to do that is what boils down to worldliness. When we begin living as if God doesn't really exist. And as we saw in the previous chapter, that is a serious sin. There were a lot of lessons for us as we consider how we are to strive to pursue wisdom from above. How we are to live in this world under the mindset that there is a God that has given us instructions. A lot of the lessons that we were to look at that dealt with rooting out worldliness in our own lives. But now James is turning his attention to a slightly different, although related, topic as we move into chapter 5. How should we, as we live within this world, interact with those who have no desire whatsoever to pursue wisdom from above? How do we interact with those that are entirely, 100% worldly? Those that do not acknowledge there is a sovereign creator, do not acknowledge God in any fashion. How do we respond to those people? Their entire approach of life is that they do not know and they do not acknowledge God. What mindset should we have when we encounter rank unbelievers? These are questions that take on the greatest of intensities when the unbelievers happen to be wealthy people, because when they're wealthy, they're in the best position to push their earthly agendas. In the Bible times, this was a very significant problem. There was a significant gap between the wealthy and the poor. There wasn't much of a middle class at all. We've come to think of the middle class as being the largest group in society. That wasn't the case in Bible times. The gap between the rich and the poor could be very, very wide. And the vast majority of the believers were poor. Very poor. So James is dealing with this situation where we have this large gap. We have a bunch of very wealthy people, and those very wealthy people are rank unbelievers. Let's see how he deals with the situation as we look at the first six verses of chapter 5 tonight. James writes, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you, and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields, and which has been withheld by you, cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. And you have lived luxuriously on the earth, and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. James here is speaking directly to the wealthy. He starts out, come now. That's a call for the readers to pay attention to what follows. We saw it a few verses before in chapter 4, verse 13, where he started a topic with come now, telling the readers that you need to pay particular attention here. Now he's once again drawing your attention, come now, but he's speaking to the rich. The rich are not the people that are going to be reading this letter. James' listeners, the ones that are going to be reading this letter, he's been writing to believers, by and large, are not the wealthy. But James' listeners are going to know with certainty from what he tells us here what the outcome of their oppressors will be. The rich men that he's given us here are apparently oppressive landowners. And they're most likely here, from what we see, unbelievers. Because the one thing he never challenges them to do is repent. It really, James sounds like an Old Testament prophet here. If you read your Old Testament prophets, they thunder against the oppressors of Israel. Many times they give these prophecies where they speak judgment on God's behalf against those who have oppressed Israel. And James is doing the similar thing here, where he's speaking this judgment against the wealthy oppressors of the poor believers. But James wasn't necessarily expecting that these people would hear his message. He's writing for the believers in the church, the ones that received this letter, the ones that are living under the impression. In a little while, when we break up into groups, we're going to ask ourselves why. Why would he write a message to a group of people that aren't going to hear that message? He says, come now, weep and howl. That term howl is a term that's used for a sound a person makes when he has extreme pain or grief. It's a term that is found in the Old Testament, in the prophets, and always in a context of judgment. Misery, pain, and the sound that comes out when you're under that kind of suffering, that's what he's saying here is going to come upon the rich. Weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Judgment is coming. And as we go into the next verses, he has four different indictments, four crimes against the wealthy that he calls out. The first one here in verses 2 and 3, the first indictment that he gives the rich has to do with the worthlessness of the worldly goods that they've been so careful to accumulate. They've been gathering this wealth, bringing it together, and it has absolutely no worth to it. In their day and age, wealth was commonly held in grain and other foodstuff. It was held in clothing. It was held in precious metals, sometimes in flocks and herds. You know, it wasn't a bank statement that held digital funds like we have today. It was intangible things is how they held their wealth. And the rich people would hoard that wealth. And that's the indictment here. Your riches that you've been hoarding have rotted. Your garments have become moth-eaten. In other words, you've held on to this stuff so long, it's become worthless. Rather than using their wealth to assist others, they've used it to fuel the fires of judgment here. He says in verse 3 that even your riches will consume your flesh like fire. It's going to become fuel on the fire that's coming upon them. The idea here of tarnishing or rusting of the gold and the silver is that they've held on to it so long that it's tarnished. In that day and age, the gold and silver coins, even though gold and silver itself do never rust, they don't tarnish, they were always mixed with large percentage of alloy, and they actually could rust given enough time. And that's the picture here, is that the wealthy have held on to all these things so long that they become worthless, and the even the rust on the coins is an indictment against them by how long they've held on to this. The point that James is making is clear that the very things that the men think are so important are spiritually worthless. They bring no value from God's perspective. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. That's James' point. It's in the last days, in these final days. The last days in the New Testament always refer to the time frame between Christ's first coming and his second coming. These are the last days. We are living in the last days when God's program is coming to its fruition. And instead of focusing on God's program and serving God's people, the wealthy have just hoarded their wealth to the point where it's rotted. As one commentator said, as those who live in these last days, we too should recognize in the grace of God already displayed and the judgment of God yet to come a powerful stimulus to share, not hoard our wealth. The first indictment is the fact that they're simply hoarding their wealth instead of making use of it. They're piling it up. And it's not worth anything in the end. Verse 4 gives us a second charge against the rich. The second charge is that they've defrauded their workers of the pay that the workers deserve. The funds are not being properly paid. The workers are not paid and are pictured as crying out to the Lord for judgment. But if you look carefully, he pictures two things as crying out. He pictures the wages themselves as crying out and the workers as crying out. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you. And then he says, the outcry of those who did the harvesting as well. So both the wages and the workers are crying out. In other words, the wages from the rich person's pocket, where they shouldn't be at this point, is crying out to God, and God is hearing that they're not where they ought to be. They're defrauding their workers. The big problem here of the rich is that they're oppressing the poor, and in the particular case here, if the manifestation of their greed is being evident by the abuse of power that they have in not paying those who had earned a wage. Lord of Sabaoth is one of the Old Testament names for God. We have it translated in some places as Lord of Hosts. It's a term that graphically declares that God is almighty. In fact, the New International Version translated God Almighty, even though that's not the literal translation for it. It gives the idea God is almighty. He is the Lord of all the armies, whether armies of the earth or armies of angels. He is omnipotent. And he is the one that's on the side of the oppressed. So another warning against those who are defrauding because of their wealth. The image that you have is these are very, very rich people. And because of that rich, they have the power to do these things. That no poor person is going to be able to bring them into court and sue them for their wages. They can't afford it. The rich person knows that. But the point is that what the rich think they do in secret, the rich think that they can do without any danger whatsoever of being prosecuted, is not hidden from the Lord of Hosts. He sees and he hears the outcry and he will bring judgment. So the first charge is that they're hoarding their wealth. The second charge is they're actually defrauding to increase that wealth. Verse 5 gives us the third accusation. The third problem is that they pursued a luxurious lifestyle that is selfish and totally unconcerned about the needs of others. They're living luxury while others are going through all kinds of hardship. And the luxury that they're living in is wanton pleasure, far beyond their basic needs, far beyond anything that you can justify. Their wealth is being used solely for display of how wealthy they are, and then solely for personal whim, whatever comes along. You have lived luxuriously on the earth. You've led a life of wanton pleasure. You've fattened your hearts. Hearts is used figuratively here. It denotes, you know, our total person, our inner life, with all of the desires and the affections that we have, what our heart craves. And he said, what you've done is you fatten those cravings. The image that he uses with that term is of cattle being fattened for the slaughter. You know, they go about day in and day out eating all the foods that's dumped before them, having no idea that the sooner they fatten themselves up, the sooner their life will end. That's the image he's given us here. These men are unaware of pending judgment. They're just like cattle who are fed on the day of slaughter. They're going about their life seeking their own pleasures in the very day when God's judgment is imminently being threatened. Judgment is coming. The last crime, the last condemnation in verse 6, is that they even go so far as they murder innocent men. That's the fourth crime they mentions here in verse 6. You've condemned and put to death the righteous man. When he uses that term condemned, the image that we hear receive is that they're probably not, you know, blatantly murdering. They're using the courts to do the work. They're working through the courts to accomplish the equivalent of murder by taking away the means for earning a living. Remember back in James 2, James was saying, why are you coattailing to the wealthy? And then in verse 6 he says, don't you remember they're the ones that drag you into court? Well, here they're condemned. So the image seems to be that the wealthy are bringing them into the courtroom. They're bringing charges against them where the poor are unable to do anything to defend themselves. And in the end, the rich are taking away their means of earning a living. And there was no welfare state back then. There wasn't any government subsidies you could fall back on. If you lost your means of earning income, you would starve. And, you know, there's other ways that we even see in the Old Testament. You think of Naboth, who had his vineyard stolen by the queen. The wealthy have ways of working through the legal channels to accomplish their end. And apparently that's what's being happened here, too, that the wealth are using that. In fact, they're using it to persecute the righteous. The righteous man who doesn't even resist. The lack of resistance by the righteous makes these attacks by the rich all the more outrageous. How can they attack the one who isn't even resisting? We don't see it in our translations because we add the word and in verse 6 a few times. But James doesn't have any conjunctions like ands in this verse. He just puts the verbs right together to intensify what's going on here. You've condemned, you put to death, he doesn't resist. It's a horrible thing that is going on here that they're doing. And he heightens that emphasis by charging that this poor man is innocent, unable to resist, and yet the wealthy are getting after him and using the legal system to basically murder him. Because when they take away his livelihood, it is a matter of life and death. So we have four accusations here. Hoarding of wealth, defrauding laborers of their dues, living in wanton pleasures, and seeking the death of innocence. Four things, four charges that James brings against these wealthy people. Four cries against those who, the reality is, will, by and large, never hear his accusations. So as we break into a group, we're going to ask ourselves why. Why did James bring this here? And what do we need to learn from these four charges? How do they apply to us? What are the overlaps between those who are extremely wealthy and the rest of us who are probably more wealthy than we think and may suffer from some of these tendencies as well? Because sin is not yet rooted out from us. Do we live in a worldly fashion at all? Can we find any worldliness in our own lives when we compare our life to those who are completely worldly, as exemplified by these wealthy people that are cried out against in these verses? We'll go ahead and break up into our groups.